Okay, so just so that we kind of make sure that we're always on the same page, especially in the introductory material, just real quick reminder, the seven churches of Asia are the recipients of the book, and I think that that's an important detail because just like in, I mean, you think about any other New Testament book, do we care who it was written to? That's a factor, right? The seven churches of Asia are Gentile congregations that this was written to. John wrote it. The date is up for grabs, and we'll talk about that tonight, because tonight we'll get into the preterist viewpoints, and that is where the dating really begins to matter. And so you have 64 to 68 A.D. is what is referred to often as the early dating of the writing of the book, or 91 to 96 A.D., which is considered the late dating. So we'll talk about that tonight, but that is debated. So as we go through the book, these are the things I really want you to remember as we look at understanding the book. Whenever we're going to understand it, we have to understand a few things up front about Revelation. The book was obviously understood by the people it was written to. Whatever interpretation we go with, and I know this is redundant because we covered this exact same slide last week, but it's redundant on purpose. Whatever interpretation of the book we use, it must be one that somebody in the first century reading Revelation could come to that same conclusion, that they could reasonably understand it the same way. It's written in the language that they could understand. So whatever tool that we use to interpret it, because symbolic language requires a key, right? It's a way I always think of it is like looking at a map. You look at a map, and there's the little blue squiggly line, and then there's the little teepee, and there's all these different signs denoting different features on a map. And where do you figure out what those mean? There's a little box down at the bottom that's the key. And that's what signs require. They require some sort of key. So whatever key that we use has to be the same key that they were capable of using. So what you'll often hear with the book of Revelation, which is a book that is kind of thoroughly abused, is somebody will say, we came up with this mathematical computation that you take these different letters and you scramble them all together and you get this. And I go, my problem is what are the chances that they were doing that back then? It's not fair that a book written to them and first and not secondary, we would have the key and them not. It doesn't make sense. And it's written using symbols they could understand. That is, the symbolism would be familiar to them. It would have to be, not only would the key have to be something they could find, but the symbology would have to make sense so that they would go, oh, we've seen this before. Right? This is something familiar enough to them. And really what that will boil down to is, I believe, quite confidently, that the key to understanding the book of Revelation is to use the other apocalyptic books of the Old Testament, which everybody would have had, which we still have, and which have the key built into them. You know, you look at Daniel, and Daniel will use apocalyptic language, but then he'll give an interpretation of it. And that's really what's going on. And it was written to be useful to them. Now, that doesn't mean it's not useful to us, but it has to be useful to them. So whatever interpretation we use has to be something that they would say, hey, this was useful. This makes sense. In the same way, and really, if you take kind of this sort of interpretive tool, these kind of rules, they really work for any New Testament book. Because you look at, like, the Corinthians, you take 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, it would have to be useful to them. They would have to be able to understand it. And any sort of figurative language used there would have to make sense to the Corinthians. So, I mean, you can do that with any book because we are secondary recipients. I mean, that's what we have to keep in mind with the New Testament is that we are secondary recipients. Doesn't mean it's not useful to us. God's written the Bible to be timeless. But we have to keep that in mind that, you know, whatever lens we use has to be the same kind of lens that they would have used.
So this is kind of a crazy argument, and not one I'm proposing, but I'm curious if it's something that people have brought up.
Okay.
So if you look at, like, Daniel, knowing that that's apocalyptic, the king needed Daniel to interpret it divinely.
Right.
Does anybody go and argue, well, yeah, the symbols wouldn't have made sense to them, but they would have had somebody miraculously interpreting them to set it so off and all this stuff? Like,
right.
Does anybody ever try to play that route and go look at Daniel and is that way?
I would love to hear the second century prophet who says there's going to be a guy in Gabbara. Okay, so directly, no, I've never heard that argument. Indirectly, that's kind of the argument that is sometimes used by the Harold Camping kind of groups, these prophetic groups that show up, as they say, I had a vision from God, and therefore I can understand the vision of Revelation. Well, that would then assume anybody who would ever understand the book of Revelation would require that divine intervention. So I've never heard that directly, but in a secondary way, if somebody comes along and says, I have a prophetic vision from God and can now understand Revelation, that would mean that that was a requirement for anybody. Yeah?
Being we're dealing with Gentiles, how important or how established would they be in Old Testament?
Okay, so one, we're dealing with Gentile churches that at this point have been around for a little while. So to put it in context, especially if you're early date or late date, but let's say you're early date, then these congregations have been around like 20 years or so. If you're late date, you're looking at these congregations have been around like 50 years or so. Well, at that point, let me put it this way. How many Christians do we have that have been Christians for 20 years that have a good solid understanding of the Old Testament?
We're doing away with the old law, and we can go more focused on new.
Well, see, I would argue it's the opposite. The new is the one that they're still compiling because it's being written as you go, so to speak, and distributed to the churches. Like in Colossians, it talks about the church at make sure that the church at Laodicea gets your letter as well. You know, these letters are being written and then distributed. The one thing that they all have a fixed copy of is the Old Testament. So that's the one set of books that they've actually had the whole time. So I would argue that actually that the transition would reemphasize the Old Testament's value because that's the one that they already had. Does that kind of make sense? Yeah.
The other thing I wonder if it's factoring too is it seems like especially the Jews who were converted in that time had an overemphasis on the Old Testament in that they just thought, well, yeah, of course we're following all these old laws and we're taking Jesus. And so I think that would have kind of naturally spread to the Gentiles getting that sense of importance of the Old Testament.
Sure.
Almost too much of anything.
Yeah, and the other thing to remember is along those same lines is with the Gentiles churches. We talk about Gentile churches versus Jewish churches. Well, it's not that black and white, right? There were Jews who converted in all of these cities too, and they would have been intermingled amongst the Gentile Christians. So you're going to have a solid Old Testament knowledge from guys and gals who converted from the Jewish realm who are now in these seven churches of Asia too. So there's quite a lot of routes and avenues that they would end up with that Old Testament knowledge by the time, even if it's the early days. Okay, anything else? Okay, so very quickly, notice I took all the animation out of it. We're just going to shoot through these very quickly. The idealist viewpoint, this is the sometimes referred to as the philosophy of history view. This one ties it to no specific historical events. That is, if we interpret it this way, it's just about a generic philosophy of God saves his people from problems. That doesn't work, though, because it's stated very clearly it's not generic. It's about something that's going to happen soon. And there'd be no way for the first century Christians to understand that it was talking about something generic. The futurist view, the premillennial view, we spent a lot of time on. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it this time. But this view takes the attitude of, you and I are living in the church age. Jesus came. He was going to be king. The Jews thwarted that plan. So the church steps in as a stopgap by God, a temporary measure. And then eventually, what happens is Jesus is going to come back and set up that kingdom that they thwarted, and it will reign for 1,000 years here on earth, being a millennial kingdom. So therefore, in the church, we are living in a premillennial time period. And this is where you get things like the Left Behind series. This is where the Rapture comes in, that entire philosophy, which dates back to 1830 with a guy by the name of John Darby. Okay, the next one was Continuous History View. This is the one that really takes the book of Revelation and says it starts with the Jews of that day, it starts with the Christians of that day, and then takes you all the way to the end of time. So it includes every major event in human history. And this view is also quite popular, and it really, its popularity is the ability to interject things like modern events, because you really then get to watch the news and then go to Revelation and go, where am I? Where are we at in here? But of course, it creates a lot of speculation. There's really no way of really nailing it down. It's a very speculative approach. It's popular, and you'll find it's popular because it allows culture to dictate the interpretation. Okay. Now, does anybody have any questions on those ones before we move to the next two, the last two? Okay. So, the next two are both preterist views. Now, preterism comes from a Latin word meaning later. Later or last? Oh no, my brain just fried. Preterism is based off of the idea of these things happening already. If you are a preterist, what you're saying is that the prophecy has happened, that it has occurred, that it's come to pass. And so a preterist viewpoint looks at the book of Revelation and says, Revelation 1, right in the beginning, says these things are shortly to come to pass. Well, I'm reading this book 2,000 years later, roughly, and so that's not shortly. So therefore, I should be looking at things that have already happened. And so preterism simply is a viewpoint that says what I read in the book of Revelation has at least in part come to pass. Now, the difference is what you're going to run into are full preterists and partial preterists. Yeah?
It says past or beyond.
Past or beyond, okay. And so a full preterist is simply one who says it's all happened. Everything that you read in the book of Revelation has already occurred. That's really all full preterism is versus partial preterism. Partial preterism says some, that may be a little bit, that may be 95%, but not all has happened. So I would fit into the category of a partial preterist. I believe that as we read through the book of Revelation, the vast majority of it has happened, but that the Bible leaves room at the end through, I think, consistent interpretation to say that the very last bits have yet to happen, and that that matches the continuity of the book. But I would not be considered a full preterist. Yeah.
To clarify, even for a full preterist, would they still see like the very, very end of Revelation? With the book of life and all that is not happening yet.
Yeah,
everybody sees that as still being
true. Nope. Full preterist says that has happened too.
Okay.
All of it. Every last letter has happened. They would view the very last chapters as being the church now. That's full preterist.
So the marriage feast or whatever
now.
Is us.
Yeah, it's already happened, and we're dealing with the
okay.
The consequences or the aftermath of that. So that's full preterism. Now, to be fair, some early date guys are not full preterists. So there is, so here's one of those things that we talk early date, late date. Those are very generic terms, right? And so we need to kind of clarify that a little bit. But in general, early date is going to be a full preterist position. And late date is going to be a partial preterist position. And like I said, you'll run into, it's like anything, you'll run into some guys who do a riff on that, right? You'll run into some early date guys who view it as primarily associated with the fall of Jerusalem, and they will say, yeah, but there's little bits like the very end there that haven't happened yet. That's not common, but it does happen. On the other hand, You will also run into some late day guys, and I've run into this, but this is also very rare, who say it has to do with the Roman Empire and the destruction of Rome and the fall of Rome and the conquering of Christianity over the Roman Empire. But they will say everything is all done. That's not normal either. So what we're dealing is generic. And some of the stuff I'm saying right now, for some of you students, you may go, I don't even know what you're talking about, Scott. If that's the case, you will soon. We'll cover it in more detail. But in general, the early date view says that the book of Revelation is about the destruction of Jerusalem, and that everything has already come to pass. The book centers around the destruction of Jerusalem, and it's fulfilled in the events of 70 AD. 70 AD is when Titus came in, destroyed Jerusalem, razed it entirely, and that is prophesied about in the Bible. Jesus talked about it in Matthew chapter 24, and they say Revelation is covering that in depth. When you get to the end with Revelation, what you've seen is the fall of the Jewish nation, and that's what it's all about, and now we're done. And so Revelation is entirely and completely fulfilled. There are multiple preterist viewpoints, but they all center around complete fulfillment of the book of Revelation. And once again, I want to emphasize, there are multiple preterist viewpoints. That you're going to run into different variations of this. But in general, full preterism says that the book is about the conquering of Judaism by Christianity. That is, Christianity survives, Judaism falls, centering that fall of Judaism around the destruction of Jerusalem, and that the whole book is completed. Does anybody have any questions? Does that kind of make sense? Yes?
This is, even though it would overlap, this is separate from 70 AD theory, right? Meaning that there are people who espouse this but don't go all the way into the entirety? Or is this just...
No, this would... Okay, I see what you're saying. So, what is often referred to as the 70 AD theory... Let's complicate this more, okay? No, 70 AD is not premillennialism. 70 AD, and is often referred to as the 70 AD theory, it's also referred to as realized eschatology, which sounds a lot like preterism, because realized eschatology means... Eschatology is the study of end times, and realized means those things at the end have been fulfilled. So it sounds a lot like preterism, but technically, we're going to be technical right now, it's a technical class. Preterism and realized eschatology are not the same thing. A preterist is saying the prophecies that are seen in the book of Revelation, a full preterist, are fulfilled. A realized eschatologist says that the end of all things, that is the second coming of Christ, has already happened. Those are not the same thing. But, here's the problem. Let me add another layer of confusion to it. If you ask a realized eschatologist, also known as a 70 AD-er, what is the event that is the second coming of Jesus that is the end of all things? And they will tell you, 70 AD, the destruction of Jerusalem. And their viewpoint on the book of Revelation will be full preterism. So, they are not the same, but they are often associated with each other. No. Homer Haley was a late date guy all the way through. What you're thinking about with him is that he decided that there is no such thing as hell.
Right. But I think the argument for that was that every time it talks about hell in the Bible, it's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem.
A lot of the argument there is based off of the idea that it's oblivion, that when it's talking about it, yeah. And so some of that is tied into the destruction of Jerusalem, some of that is tied into the idea that it's
just separation.
Right, it's just a total oblivion and destruction, yeah. So, have I complicated things enough? Yeah.
So, if Homer Haley says there's no hell.
Well, no, Homer Haley doesn't say anything when he's dead. He wrote a book right near the end of his life where he came to the conclusion that hell actually is just oblivion, that you're just totally destroyed. He's wrong. Men are wrong on different things, and I'm sure that at some point somebody will find that I came to an erroneous conclusion, too. Of course, that won't be true because I'm always right. Yeah.
Not to complicate it, but just to help resolve a little bit, I think I remember my grandpa saying something about he heard from a family member something that they heard Homer Haley saying he never wanted to release that book, but then it got released, and I think he was actually conflicted on that viewpoint and maybe turned it back. Just to resolve the whole spectrum of whatever, but anyway.
Regardless, I mean,
yeah.
I'm not a Haleyite. So, so 78, this, what is often referred to as the 70 AD theory, says that Jesus has already returned. That's already happened. He's already come back. It is a false doctrine. It is a false teacher. And it has upset the faith of many. And it is wrong in every respect. And guys who are 70 AD guys, I have never met a 70 AD guy who is not a full preterist. But I have met full preterists who are not 70 AD guys. Does that clarify it for you? All dolphins are porpoises, but not all porpoises are dolphins. A square rectangle. Yes, all squares are rectangles, but not all rectangles are squares. I like animals. You like geometry. Okay, so for the sake of Revelation, though, what we're looking at is it about the destruction of Jerusalem? Now, the pros of this viewpoint is, well, if it's about the destruction of Jerusalem, then the book would certainly fit the category, a short way to come to pass and be a blessing to first century readers. Do you realize that right now we just made a change from every other interpretation that we've used? In every other interpretation we used, that statement was in the con category. You realize that? We just, for the first time, moved it over to the pro category. So we now are moving closer to logically looking at this book. And it fits nicely with the prophecy found in Matthew 24. Now, here is the thing. If you look at Matthew chapter 24, that is, I think the context clearly is saying that that's a prophecy about the destruction of Jerusalem. That Jesus pointed to all the stones of the temple and all the things, and said, all of these are going to be torn down, and then prophesied. Well, that gives pretty good context, doesn't it? That Matthew 24 is about the fall of Jerusalem. Now, here's the thing. Matthew 24 uses some of that same apocalyptic type language. So, what happens is, people then go, okay, the language is similar, so they must be about the same thing. But there's a logic flaw in that. Because if you go to the Old Testament and you look at those apocalyptic books, they use the similar language, but they're not all about the same stuff. Right? And so it's important to understand that similarity is not the same as being the same. Right? There's a lot of things in life that are that way. And so you could even argue, well, the reason they're similar is, in Matthew 24, who does the talking? Who gives that prophecy? Jesus. Do you know who gave the vision to John? Jesus. So it's apocalyptic language from the same person. You would expect a similarity of voice, right? You could use it the same way. Evolutionists will argue that whales have similar bones to human beings. Well, does that mean that whales are, you know, human beings and whales evolved from one from the other? No, it just means they have a common designer, right? We share a deeper amount of our DNA with bananas, exactly. Yeah, no, that's really true. You take DNA of a banana, and you take the DNA of you, and you have something in common. That's not because you evolved from a banana. It's not any of my relatives. But it does mean, it could just as easily be interpreted as DNA comes because there's a common designer. So just because the language is similar does not mean they are similar. And so we have to be careful with that. But under the protocol, it is true, it does fit nicely with the prophecy found in Matthew 24. Okay, here are the cons to it. The entire argument rests on the book being written before 70 AD when earliest historians say it was. That's a big one. The earliest historians, and we'll look at some of that external evidence, say that the book was written during Domitian's reign, And Domitian didn't reign until the 90s. And so you've got... But the problem is if the book is about is a prophecy, that means something that hasn't happened yet, right? If a prophecy about the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, it definitely has to be written before 70 AD. So that's a major issue. That the earliest historians don't date it there. And why is it written to churches in Asia, primarily Gentile congregations and Gentile-controlled cities, when it deals with the persecution centered around Jerusalem? I really struggle with that. That's, to me, one of the major problems with that early date view is just simply, let's start at the beginning of context. Now, if I want it to be about the destruction of Jerusalem, I can find a lot of similar symbology and I can kind of work it around to that if I start with that premise. But if I start with the premise of saying, who is it written to? How would they benefit from it? What is the world that they were living with? And I take it from that standpoint up front, it doesn't make sense for it to center around the destruction of Jerusalem. It makes sense for it to be something that would deeply impact these Gentile congregations in the tribulation that they were going to face. Because if you look at Revelation 1, go turn over to Revelation chapter 1, and look down in verse 9 of chapter 1. John writes and says, I, John, both your brother and companion in the tribulation and kingdom and patience of Jesus Christ, was on the island that is called Patmos for the word of God and for the testimony of Jesus Christ. John says they are companions. The seven churches of Asia that he's writing to are companions with him in the kingdom. Well, that makes sense, right? They're all Christians. They're all in the kingdom. And he also says they're companions in the tribulation. That is, the trials and suffering that he's going to tell them about, these tribulations that are going on, that John was a companion of them with, which, by the way, who would have banished John to Patmos? Would have been Jews? It's going to be Rome, right? Regardless of which Roman emperor it is, regardless of whether it's Nero that banished him to Patmos, which is what it would have to be if you take an early date view, or it's Domitian, which would be the late date view. We'll actually look at some pictures of those guys so you can kind of get some of them together. Then, if they're companions in this tribulation together, the tribulation that John was facing at that particular time was one of Roman persecution, and he's speaking to Gentile Christians living in a Roman-controlled territory. So it makes sense from that context that would be what we're looking at. Yes, sir? You solved it?
Yeah. I had a question, but I was able to answer
it. I was going to say, I have no idea what you solved, but okay, great. Okay. And then last, internal evidence points to later dating and a worldwide struggle with Roman emperor worship. And so we'll look at some of these things. I think, you know, we've talked about the first con there is external evidence. The last con is internal evidence. And we'll look at both of those. I think it's valuable to look at external, but I always will weigh internal evidence the highest, right? Using the Bible to interpret itself is hands down the best thing, because then you know you're using the same tools that they have. I always find it a tricky thing whenever your interpretation of a book requires you to have an understanding of something outside of the Bible. That's nerve-wracking. And one of the reasons that I'm a late-date guy is because the external evidence, if you take the early-date view, the external evidence is against you, but it also matters, right? It matters whether it's early-date or late-date. Technically, as a late date view, it doesn't matter. The only interpretation of the book that cares about the date of the book is the one that has to have it written before 70 AD, right? So for me, whether it was dated, whether it was written from 60 to 64 AD or whether it was written in the 90 ADs, doesn't really matter, because the interpretation of the book that I hold to, works either way. But if you take an early date view, it has to be before 70 AD because the whole point of the book is a prophecy of the destruction of Jerusalem. So that's always felt to me to be a struggle with that standpoint. Does anybody have any questions? Yeah.
Would it be too early to ask, because this is where you and Oliver would disagree, and I'm curious to get somebody's viewpoint who would disagree with you. Like, would it be too early to ask what the arguments to these are?
Oh, I can tell you the arguments to those. And to be fair, you guys keep making it an Oliver Scott thing. That is not true. I don't even know what Oliver believes on the subject. So, no, somebody asked me what was Oliver's point of view, and I cracked a joke. There's a difference. Okay. The evidence on the external dating would be, you look at, there's quotes from Irenaeus and Eusebius and Victorinus and Clement of Alexandria, and they are mentioned John being imprisoned during Domitian's reign, which would make it late date. The arguments against that are, well, this guy's quoting this guy, he's quoting this guy, and they're all using the same source, and that source is erroneous.
Was it also possible that John was in the 90s, or is that...
The late date says he was imprisoned in the 90s. So the counter argument to that, the way that they would handle the external evidence, which as far as I know, all the early daters admit that the external quotes say that it was late date. The way they handle that is saying those quotes were wrong because this guy was quoting this guy and this guy was quoting that guy, and this guy over here was kind of vague, and we have a copy over here where it doesn't mention Domitian. It just calls him the tyrant, and that's vague, and so that's how they handle that particular detail of it. As far as I know, that second argument, why is it written in the churches in Asia, I've never gotten a good argument on that. And that's one that I camp a lot on that particular issue, because I've never gotten a good argument to it. Why was it written to these seven churches in Asia if it's really dealing with a Judean Christian problem? The early date view would say that the internal evidence points to early dating and a worldwide struggle with Rome through Jerusalem. So they would say that the internal evidence. I think so. Yeah, I think as we move through. So, okay. So the sometimes referred to as the late date view. This is the historical background view, and I don't know why they call it the historical background view. You could also call it partial preterist view. There's a lot of names that people like to give these different views, and it just kind of gets boring at a certain point. But this would be my view. The historical background view advocates seeing Revelation as written for the people of that day and set in a definite historical background. Okay, so that's in comparison to the philosophy idea, or that it's, you know, talking about jet planes and World War II. And the book deals with persecutions of second and third century of the second and third century church, specifically Roman persecution. So instead of the book centering around the destruction of Jerusalem, the book now the historical background view says what it centers around is the destruction of Rome. And I think there's a lot of strong biblical evidence for why that story really needed to be told. I think Daniel requires that story be told. And I'll talk about that a little bit more, about how Daniel really left that story left to be explained. This view leaves room for some events to not yet be fulfilled, but the context of the book must make it clear that those events are still far off. So that is, as we read through Revelation, the things are shortly to come to pass, unless right at the end, and what you'll see as we go through the book, is if you get right to the end, it will be clear from the writing, this stuff is far off. So the book as a whole is about things shortly to come to pass, but there is some things that are left for the future. The last two chapters in particular are dealing with events that still haven't happened yet. The pros of this view, the book would certainly shortly come to pass and be a blessing to first century readers. This is, once again, we've now had this show up in the pro column. It allows a concrete interpretation of the book without walking into some predetermined philosophy. That is, of all of the viewpoints, this is the one that I think what you can do is you start at the beginning of the book, you compare it to the apocalyptic language of the Old Testament, and as you progress forward, you go, this has got to be about Roman persecution. Instead of deciding ahead of time, this is about Roman persecution, or this is about World War II, or this is about destruction of Jerusalem, and then trying to interpret the book based off of that view, you go in as a blank slate. And as you go in as a blank slate, I think that naturally that is where the book leads you, is to an understanding that this should be this is about the church facing and dealing with Rome. And that's really, I think, the way it should be, right? If we do it right, the book should explain itself as you go. You shouldn't have to go in with the preconceived notion. Isn't that where bad interpretation happens? Right? The worst sermons, the sermons of false teachers, happen when a guy says, I've decided this is what I want to preach on, and this is the view, and then tries to find some verses on it. Right? When you enter into something and say, I've already decided I'm going to preach that this is the case, and then you go to find verses, what do you always find? You find what you want. That's what happens. You find what you want. I can preach anything from the Bible if I take stuff out of context. But good hermeneutics, good interpretation says, I don't know what it says, let the book tell me. And I think that as you look at the book of Revelation, that what it tells you is about a suffering of Christians during the age of Rome, when Rome decides to exterminate Christianity, wipe it out from the face of the planet, throw them to the wolves and the lions of the Colosseum, and how Christianity survives that, and how God blesses his people through the most terrifying time that they've ever faced historically. I think that comes naturally from the book. And it follows the same pattern as other apocalyptic books. That is, it's the same, you're using the same language in the same sort of way. It's the same kind of topic. Apocalyptic books should be about national upheaval. And it uses that same kind of hold. But to be fair, even though this is my view, let me put the cons on there too. It's not as popular as the futurist view. And I know that sounds like a tongue-in-cheek con. Like I'm just throwing that up there just to, you know. But it is a legitimate one. Because I use this, you know, to be fair. In teaching, I do the same thing. It's not fair for me to sometimes, when all of the commentators agree, because I've done this before, somebody brought up a question and said, well, Scott, why isn't it this? And I go, you know, honestly, I've never thought about that viewpoint before, but I can tell you this. I read 15 commentators on that subject, and all 15 took the same position I had. That doesn't mean I'm right, but it does put a burden of evidence there, doesn't it? I mean, if I'm going to take a different opinion than 15 theologians who've spent a lot of time, I ought to really think about it. Well, the truth is that the opinion, the viewpoint that I'm going to teach you here is not the most popular out there. Not even by a long shot. It is much more popular to be premillennial. It is much more common to have a futurist viewpoint to say this is all stuff that's way off in the future. And you should factor that in, right? Put my feet to the flame on it. If I'm going to say something that goes counter to 95% of the religious commentators out there on the book of Revelation, you know, I ought to know what I'm talking about. So I know that Christianity and biblical interpretation is not a popularity contest. But on the other hand, you should weigh that in when a guy comes along with an opinion that's very different than the vast majority of people. And that really is true. The opinion that I'm going to teach is very different than what you would see in the religious world as a whole. Well, that's true. That's true. But I also expect you to hold my feet to the flame on that stuff too. You know? So, what? I know. It hurts. It's painful. I go home and I cry every time. The other con, and this is a legitimate one as well, I actually, this took a long time. That's it. Whenever you've decided something, you're sure you're right, then you have to go out and say why you could possibly be wrong. These were hard. The cons, the other con is it doesn't answer the specifics of the imagery. Now, I don't think it's meant to. In fact, I think that the problem a lot of times with the Book of Revelation is that people try and get way more specific than is intended. But you can read, well, like, you take, okay, this is an early date one. This is like the textbook for early date. This is a bigger book with lots of tiny print. This is about half the weight of that. And this is a late date one. Now, I know that's kind of, they look similar, but these are really thick pages. Anyways, this one is full of very specifics. 666 is not just a generic statement of something that is unholy. 7 is holy and 666 would be unholy. That would be my viewpoint. They're going to say 666 is Neron Caesar. And you can do the math on it. And each letter in his name is a number. And you can, and so you, you know, whenever you can get specific, it's really exciting. And you feel strong in it. You're like, ooh, I've got a very specific thing. You know, there will be things in the imagery, and they'll say, that has to do with this one specific thing that Josephus said happened at the destruction of Jerusalem. And they're very, very specific. And I'm not going to give you that. Now, the reason I'm not going to give you that is because I don't think that that's the way apocalyptic language works. I don't think it's meant to be done that way. In the same way that I don't think the parables are meant to be done that way. You take the parable to Jesus, and he's got, here's 100 sheep, and there's one sheep, and so the shepherd goes off and grabs them, and he puts them on his shoulders, and he comes back. Hey, what? We could really dial down there, couldn't we? And we could get so specific on that parable that we miss the point of the parable. The parable doesn't have a million points to it. It is one. And Jesus tells you what that one is at the end. There'll be more joy in heaven over one sinner that repents than over 100 that don't need to repent. So parables are not meant to be dialed down to, well, what was the color of the sheep's wool? Right? Okay, you missed the point. Apocalyptic language, I don't believe, is meant to be done the same way too, but it can feel somewhat unsatisfying. I mean, that's the trade-off. And I've had this when I teach this view, and I'm kind of front-loading a little bit for you. That there will be times when I say, okay, look at the overarching image. This is the overarching picture. And I can't give you specifics on every little detail. But it paints a big, broad picture with that imagery, and that's what it's going for. Apocalyptic language is meant to be illustrated. It's meant to be on a large scale, to paint a big picture for you. And just like when you're watching a movie, you don't dial in on extra number 257 standing in the right back corner of the background. You're looking at the overarching picture. Apocalyptic language is meant to be the same way. And so we have, I'm not, you'll find that I'm more generic in my teaching on the subject than other viewpoints. I believe that that's the way it's supposed to be, but it also would be a con because it can frustrate students. And I think the appeal of a lot of times of the other viewpoints is that they offer specifics. But I, in my opinion, as I've looked at it, those specifics are offered by doing some reaching. You definitely see that from the futurist standpoint when they start trying to interpret it, this is airplanes and this is Obama or this is whatever. There's a lot of reaching going on. But it's very satisfying to look into the book and they go, oh, I saw Obama! You know? Oh, President, I didn't expect it this early. And that's really so much of a clap. But, you know, that there's a satisfaction in that sort of specificity. And I won't be offering that to you. Sorry. Does that make sense? Does anybody have any questions on that? Yeah.
Do you think that the futurist view is maybe a lot more popular just because people don't study their own?
Oh, yeah, for sure, right? You know, well, you look at Revelation 1, he says, blessed is he who reads and those who hear the words of this prophecy and keep those things which are written in it for the time is near. he really emphasizes, this is one of the few books in your New Testament that there's this emphasis put on, listen up, listen carefully. It's kind of like Jesus would do, right? He who has ears to hear, let him hear. It's like, listen up. Well, you give that warning when you're running into tougher stuff. And I think that is exactly right. With Revelation, you're dealing with tougher stuff, and there's a lot of people who don't have the foundation to deal with it. So it's very easy to be derailed into the future view when you don't have any sort of grounding in this language from somewhere else in the Bible. So yeah, I think that's absolutely true. A lack of knowledge, I mean, Hosea was really true on it. My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. That absolutely is true.
Well, it's very entertaining, too.
Well, that's true. Who doesn't like dragons? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, you're right. And absolutely, it's much more flashy, for sure.
The other thing that I think might cause this to be less popular, I was just looking up, I was trying to find like somebody who really did disagree with it and what points they did. Uh-huh. Honestly, you probably got better cons than the people who disagreed with you did. So good job. But, and I remember this too from when when we were doing our, I think it was when we were studying Matthew 24 and stuff.
Okay.
And I was reading an article that at the time I thought was really powerful about arguing against this, and it sounds convincing because it'll start off with you use an inconsistent interpretation. So some things are historical and then some are just spiritualized. And I think part of the reason that people don't buy into it is because you hear, inconsistent interpretation, that, yeah, they're not being honest. But when you actually look at what the view is, those arguments don't even line up.
Right.
Like when you get to the what they're saying is historical and what's not, it doesn't even match what the view is really saying.
Yeah.
And so I think it's just that people may not hear it from a quote-unquote good enough partial prayers.
And
I've heard that, and obviously there's problems, and then you just move on.
Right. Well, you take a hard book, and then you take somebody who teaches the book who's not doing a good job at it, and you just make it worse, right? You know, I mean, there's a lot of things in life like that. So, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Between full and partial,
which is the
most popular?
Full. Or partial. Partial is full is the least popular. Early date is a less popular view than late date. Late date has been around. Let me put it this way. I think late date has been around since he wrote it. But if you look at historically, early date didn't start showing up until more recently in the last 100 years or so, has become a more common view, whereas late date can be viewed back, I think, to like 1500s, if I remember. Don't quote me on that, but there's a gap there. And so the late date partial preterist view is more popular, certainly within the church. I would say that you're probably looking at, and of course I'm just going to throw numbers out here that I think are close, a 75-25 split would be what I expect. Probably 75% are going to be late date and 25% early date.
Did the early date stuff kind of come in at the same time as the 70-80 stuff, or are those two totally separate movements?
Not totally separate movements, but one led to the other. So the early date movement gained popularity, mm-hmm. and then as you grab the full preterist view, exactly. You begin to say, is everything in the Bible, every prophecy in the Bible already fulfilled? And so you begin to find everything in it. Now, obviously not everybody does that, but one did absolutely become the catalyst to the other. And it has been used as an argument that therefore the early date view is wrong because look at where it leads. I think that's a bad argument, though, right? It's not fair to say, well, these guys went all crazy over here, so whatever they believed before they went crazy must also be wrong. I'm trying to be fair about arguments that get used. Some of them aren't good arguments, right? But it would definitely be one led to the other. Early date came first, and then 70 AD rolled out of that. Anything else? Yes. Okay, so the reason I get that viewpoint is when you go back to the Old Testament and you look at apocalyptic language, which we get the interpretation for, with that, nobody expects it to be specific. Like, I've never run into anybody who is the Old Testament apocalyptic language that does the same things that they do to Book of Revelation. So they go and they look at apocalyptic language that talks about the destruction of Babylon. And it's the same kind of language. Big, massive imagery, all these different things. And guys teach it, and you know what they do? They go, so the overarching message here is this. And I think they're right in doing that. But then we get to Revelation, and I don't know whether it's because it's in the New Testament. I don't know because we just get excited about it. I don't know what the reason is, but we just totally flip that over there. So my logic is that in the Old Testament with apocalyptic language, going through the prophets, we don't expect that. Nobody, I don't know anybody who ever has to the level of detail. In fact, I don't know anybody who even thinks it's possible to have that level of detail. The only way you can get the level of detail of specifics of the imagery of Revelation with the early date view is if you have a copy of the book of Josephus. Because Josephus wrote down the destruction of Jerusalem. He was outside with the Roman. He was a Roman historian. He was a Jew who was a Roman historian. There's a whole thing about how a Jew became a Roman historian. But he was outside the walls of Jerusalem when it was destroyed, when Rome encamped around it, and he gives us this really detailed account of exactly what happened. So, if you have Josephus, what happens is you have Josephus' account of the destruction of Jerusalem, and then your view is Revelation is about the destruction of Jerusalem, and so you begin to connect these things. Well, you can't do that anywhere else, and that's another reason that kind of concerns me is, really, from my viewpoint, in order to have the proper early date view, you need to have Josephus. And there's at least one preacher that I know that he goes, oh yeah, absolutely. You have to have Josephus. But God gave it to him, gave us Josephus, so. And that's how he shrugs his shoulders at it. To me, that's some dicey territory to move into. But, yeah. It's not in there, yeah. But, in the old, to get back to the original question, Old Testament prophets, apocalyptic prophecy, which is really a mouthful, I'm realizing. We don't expect that level of specificity, and so it's consistent to not expect it in the New Testament. Does that kind of answer it for you? Okay. Okay, anything else? Okay. So, let's talk here about the Caesars and the early date versus late date. Now, here's the deal. You have these different Caesars, starting with Nero. Now, the reason we start with Nero is Nero, if the early date view is right, Nero was the Caesar during the time when the book of Revelation was written, which means he's the Caesar that put John on the island of Patmos. Okay? There is definitely evidence that Nero didn't like Christians. If you've ever heard the phrase, Nero fiddled while Rome burned, which is kind of an archaic phrase, but it's that is referring to the fact that Nero, at one point, history tells us that Nero, it was probably Nero, who caught the city of Rome on fire. And he burned a big portion of it, and most people think it was him, because the portion of Rome that burned, he wanted to build like a real big estate park for himself, and it just happened to burn down, and then he was able to build this real cool fun park for himself, because all those people were kicked out. But everybody seemed to think it was Nero, and they were very, very upset with him. And so all of these people didn't like Nero. So Nero is in trouble for the destruction of all this property in Rome, and so he needed a scapegoat. And guess who he used? He said it was Christians. So Nero persecuted Christians. And then you have this gap after Nero. And Galba, Otho, and Vitellius, all of these guys, if you look at the dating, 68, 69, 69, 69, it's a very short period of time, these three guys. These guys fought over being Caesar. Nero died, killed himself. And these three guys fought over the kingdom for a course of about a year. There's a civil war. Then a guy by the name of Vespasian came in. And Vespasian, he came in and he took over, got rid of these three guys, and he took over and ruled. And then after he ruled, his son Titus, who was the guy that destroyed Jerusalem, before, while his dad, Vespasian, was Caesar, Titus destroyed Jerusalem. And then he became Caesar afterwards. And during that time period, from Galba, Otho, Vitellius, Vespasian, and Titus, historically we don't really hear of there being any sort of major persecution of Christians whatsoever. It's only till Domitian shows up, where everybody agrees Domitian hated Christians. He hated them because they wouldn't worship him as God. Domitian had a big head, definite arrogance. He believed he was God. He believed that everybody should worship him as God. Emperor worship was a big part of his goal of reinstating into the Roman Empire. And when he ruled, anybody who wouldn't listen to him, he wanted to put to death. Well, guess who really stood out at that point, especially since in 70 AD, the Jews have basically become a non-issue because they've been wiped out. So who's the only group of people left who will not accept him as God? Christians. That's all that's left. So, here's two guys. Now, after Domitian, there's a lot of guys after that who continued to persecute Christians. But in this span, before Nero, there weren't any Caesars that persecuted Christians. Then Nero did it because of the Roman fire. And then there's a gap here. And then Domitian's the next guy to show up to really purposely persecute Christians. So this is, once again, the early date, late date argument. Is if it's about a trial that Christians were going to face, Nero or Domitian are the two kind of beginning elements of that process. So you have to kind of decide which one of those you're going to follow. So that's why you'll hear a lot of Nero versus Domitian. There's no doubt that Nero persecuted Christians. It's under Nero's reign that Paul was put to death. There's no doubt that Domitian did. The guys in between, pretty much everybody agrees, nobody was doing it. So it's kind of got to start with one of those guys, that tribulation. Yeah. Okay, and that actually is one of my problems with the Nero one, is that Nero, as far as we can tell, the scope of his persecution, everybody agrees he persecuted Christians, but the scope of it was the city of Rome and the provinces around. It didn't go Rome-wide. Domitian, everybody agrees it did. The entire civilized world, but there's really not a lot of evidence with Nero that it really went beyond that Roman province of the city itself and the provinces around it, and which creates a problem for the seven churches of Asia if it's about Nero.
Paul of Jerusalem referred to no Jews left. Would that have ended the persecution of the new church by the Jews, which is probably the Saul?
It would certainly have ended. I mean, it's not going to stop Jews hating Christians, right? But it stops any sort of concerted Jewish effort post-70 AD because they're not organized anymore, right? There's no, you know, remember Paul getting letters from Jerusalem to go, there's nobody to get letters from. There's no authority. So you would be dealing now with private persecution, which is kind of like what you and I face, right? Christians today, can they face persecution? Yeah, but it's not organized. It's disorganized persecution. Let's see somebody over. Yes.
Did some reading on history of the seven churches of Asia.
Uh-huh.
And during the late days, during the mission, there was a lot of very strong pressure against over half of the seven churches in Asia for emperor worship.
Right.
There was really good pressure.
Well, one of the things that the mission did was he would go into all of these different major cities, of which the seven churches of Asia are major cities, and he would set up a temple there for emperor worship. I mean, that was a national dictate. So now you have pressure in the very cities that you're in to do that, and if you won't burn your pinch of incense to Caesar, you know, you're in trouble. It was treated as a tax, by the way, Emperor worship was treated like a tax. Everybody, you don't have to worship him every day, right? Because you always run into the issue how often you have to worship the emperor. We got, and he was okay with worshiping other gods too. You could do that. You could worship the emperor and also Zeus and also Hermes and Venus and all these others. But at least once a year, you had to go and give a pinch, burn a pinch of incense to the emperor. And that was what Domitian really put into place. It was the beginning of that process. Now, the guys after him kept it going. Because, hey, once you've made yourself a god, why not keep rolling with it? But he was the guy who really instituted that on a national scale. And that did go into Asia. Yeah, absolutely. As we mentioned the different names, these are the kind of the names that will come up. Titus is important because he was the general at the time that Jerusalem was destroyed. Vespasian is important because he was just a really important Caesar, actually. He was, as far as Caesars go, not a bad dude. Nero is important because he's really the first time Caesar ever did persecute Christians. And Domitian was the beginning of really, really horrible times from that point forward, with only very small breaks in between. You would have every once in a while an emperor that would kind of slack off on the pressure, but never remove it. They kind of like, you know how we have laws on the book now, but we say we're not going to enforce them? That's what would happen sometimes. Every once in a while you would have an emperor and say, we're keeping the laws on the book, but don't enforce them right now. And then somebody would show up and they would reinforce them. So they really never went away after Domitian until Rome went away. Okay, external evidence for the late date. Nero's persecution is historically considered localized to Rome and the surrounding provinces. We kind of talked about this. That was what you brought up. Some of this stuff will go fairly quickly because as we've been talking, it has come quickly. So if it doesn't make sense for Nero because it was just a localized persecution. It was a persecution. Nobody's denying that. But it was, as far as we can tell, historically localized to Rome and the surrounding provinces. That's, once again, external evidence. Nero's persecution was short-lived. It was only roughly 2 years. So Nero's reign was from 64 to 68 A.D., and from 64 to 66 was when this whole Roman fire thing happened, and then he left, because the fireman went on and went away for a while. He was still Caesar, but he left Rome to just kind of like let the heat die down, and then he came back later. That was a good joke, right? Yeah, okay. So really, it's, I mean, 2 years, it was a short-lived persecution. Not of the kind of caliber that you see Revelation talking about. Domitian is known for beginning the religious attack on Christians over the Roman cultus. Roman cultus, that is the Caesar worship, the cult of Rome that worshiped Caesar. And it was a religious attack. Nero used Christians as a scapegoat, but it wasn't really religion. He was using them as this weird group of people who we don't like, so let's be mad at them. Domitian was the one who made it a personal religious attack. Early writers wrote of John being in prison during Domitian's reign, and I mentioned already some of these guys' names, Irenaeus, Clement, who was then quoted by Eusebius, which is one of the counter-arguments. They say, well, we didn't actually hear Clement. We've got the writings of Eusebius who quotes Clement, but we don't actually have Clement's original, and so that's one of the arguments against it. And then another guy by the name of Victorinus. And they are all quoted as saying that when John wrote it, it was during Domitian's reign. That's external evidence. I don't use external evidence as my final proof for things, but it is that is the external evidence. Now let's look at the internal evidence, which I think is much more important. The letters written to Gentile Christians in Asia that were companions in the tribulation. I know that this is a dead horse that I keep hitting, but they were companions in the tribulation that John was facing. John was facing a Roman persecution by being put on the Isle of Patmos. They were companions with John, and the trials that he's going to write to them about are shortly to come to pass as something they're going to be facing together. And that matches a Roman persecution much better than it matches a Jewish persecution and fall in Jerusalem. All biblical evidence points toward the Jews holding no sway on Roman powers outside of Judea. Okay, now here's what I mean by all biblical evidence. There are external writings that talk about, well, Jews did this, and this is how they tried to get Christians persecuted, and this and that, through the Romans. But in your Bible, as you read the Bible, what happened when the Jews went to the Romans outside of Jerusalem? Not in Jerusalem. In Jerusalem, we know what happened when they went to Pontius Pilate, right? It worked, right? They had sway over Pilate. Pilate didn't like it, but they were his constituents. That's what you got to do. But outside of there, outside of Jerusalem and Judea, whenever the Jews tried to involve the Romans in the process of persecuting Christians, you had the Romans saying, we're not going to do that. And the classic example is Acts 18. So if you look over in Acts chapter 18, this is in the city of Corinth. Acts 18, you have Paul there. Paul is afraid for his life in Corinth, and he thinks that he'll be killed. And God comes to a vision, and he says, I'm with you. No one will attack you in this city. And so Paul's been preaching there a year and 6 months. And then verse 12, it says, when Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, so this is a Roman authority, the Jews with one accord rose up against Paul and brought him to the judgment seat. That is the Roman judgment seat. Saying, this fellow persuades men to worship God contrary to law. So they tried to get the Romans involved with it. And when Paul was about to open his mouth, Gallio said to the Jews, if it were a matter of wrongdoing or wicked crimes, those Jews, there would be reason why I should bear with you. But it is a question of words and names in your own law. Look to it yourselves, for I do not want to be a judge of such matters. And he drove them from the judgment seat. That was the general view outside of Judea of the Roman rulers. Yes?
It seems like that's also supported by later on when Paul was in trial, and he just threw out on trial for the resurrection, and then all the Jews went crazy, and then he kind of, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well,
they're kind of like, you guys debate your own stuff, because I'm not going to get into this.
Absolutely. Think about what Paul did when he was on trial and then he was kept in prison in Herod's palace there. What was his final solution? I appeal to Caesar, right? He thought he'd get a fair trial with Caesar. Once I leave this Judean province, then maybe some of the crazy... And you know, historically that worked, right? Because he went there, he went to Caesar, and he was released. So the view historically that your Bible gives is that the Jews hated Christians, absolutely persecuted them wherever they could, but the Romans and their authority were not swayed by the Jews. They were irritated by them, which is a very different view than what you find in the early date view. The early date view tends to look at the Romans as more of a being used by the Jews to persecute the Christians. But I don't see that biblically, internally, I don't see anything to point that was what was happening. Another is, as you look at Revelation, you have these seven churches. Well, the Ephesian church seems to have changed considerably by the time of Revelation's writing. Right? When you look at the letter of Ephesians that was written, good church, doing well, very pleased with them. Paul warns them near the end of his life that something's going to happen, but if the early date is true, that something happened within a couple of years. Because the early date viewpoint would have at like 64 A.D., and Paul would have been passing through right around 60 A.D., and so it didn't take very long for them to go from a group that Paul praised and loved, and that loved Paul and wept on his neck when he had to leave, to now a leadership that has left its first love and is about to have their lampstand removed. Along those same lines, Laodicea, which in the book of Revelation has not a single commendation to its name. Right, Laodicea is the only church of the seven churches that when they get their report cards doesn't get anything good. Everything is bad for Laodicea. The lukewarm church that I'll vomit out of my mouth. Well, you compare that to Colossians 4:13 where Paul says to the Colossians, he says, you have a letter and the Laodiceans have a letter, make sure you swap, and you know, there's no problem there. So we move from the Laodiceans being a church that Paul would just say, hey, he would casually mention to the Colossian church as, these guys are good, make sure they get a copy of your letter, everything's fine, to now all of a sudden we're switching to, they're a total train wreck, and Jesus is totally ready to vomit them out of his mouth and completely displeased with them. And so there's an internal evidence for time having to have gone by. which once again passes the 70 AD mark, and that's all you have to do to remove that interpretation, right? Then the beast of Romans 13, and we'll talk about this more, and actually just the next couple of slides here, but the beast of Romans 13 is decidedly the Roman Empire. And the false prophet, which is also in Romans 13, supports that beastly empire. The imagery in Romans 13, you get this image of this beast, and it is an exact replica, just spot on, for what Daniel says is the Roman Empire. Because Daniel gives a description of the Roman Empire as a beast, and then says, this is the Roman Empire.
Is this Romans 13, not Revelation 13?
No. Revelation 13, that's a typo.
No, that's a total typo.
It's Revelation 13. Thank you. Yes. Revelation 13 gives this picture of this beast. Yeah, keep looking at Romans 13. It's just, it's not there. Yeah. No, Revelation 13 gives this picture of this beast, and it's an exact copy of the beast that Daniel points out in chapter 7, Daniel 7. And says is the fourth empire, which is the Roman Empire. And so there's no doubt in Daniel 7 that beast is the Roman Empire. And then you've got the exact same language over in Revelation 13. And then what you're also told in Revelation 13 is that the people are told to worship that beast. So who are they worshiping? They're worshiping Rome, which is emperor worship, Caesar worship. And so that lines up beautifully. Now, here's that imagery of Daniel. And this is where, what my view is, Daniel told a story through the dream of Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel 2, and then through Daniel 7, the dream of the beast. He told a story, but he left the story unfinished. And Revelation finishes it. Because in Daniel 2, you have that vision Nebuchadnezzar had of the statue, and each part of the statue is a different kingdom, and we're given that interpretation. Babylon is the head of gold, then the kingdom follows Medo-Persia, which is called out in Daniel 7, Greece, and then eventually Rome. And then Daniel gives a very similar, that these different caliber of nations, because you have the gold all the way down to the iron. So you have a decreasing quality of nation, but also an increasing strength of nation, right? Rome, much stronger than Babylon, much more corrupt. Daniel then gives these has another vision here with all these different beasts. And so Babylon is described as a lion with eagle's wings. When you think about, what do we think of the king of beasts? That is the lion. What is the national bird because of that dignity and everything to it? The eagle. It has it's the same as gold. You have then the bear with three ribs in its mouth, the leopard with four wings and four heads. Greece was a very fast nation. It spread fast under Alexander the Great, just like a leopard. The leopard with four sets of wings, it's like a leopard with a rocket pack. You know, how quickly does he go? And then the last beast that Daniel gets in his vision is not a real beast at all. It's this totally apocalyptic language. It's a ten-horned beast, unlike the others, with iron teeth, a boasting horn, and dreadfully terrifying. Well, this last beast is Rome. Well, then if you go over to Revelation 13 and you look at the beast there, the description is almost identical of the beast that comes out of the sea. It's dreadfully terrifying. It has these horns. It has the teeth. It is all of these things that match that vision of Daniel. And so that internal evidence points towards a book that's talking about that beast that Daniel left us with. Because really, you think about it, another way to look at this is Daniel chapter 2, Daniel is told, in the days of those kings, that is, there's all these different kingdoms, in the days of those kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, nor shall the sovereignty thereof be left to another people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. The great beasts which are four are four kings that shall arise out of the earth, but the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. This is what the book of Revelation is about. It's the rest of the story. Daniel is given a vision all the way back in the Old Testament. He says, there's going to be four kings, four kingdoms. And those four kingdoms are going to come along, and then during the reign of the fourth kingdom, what's going to happen? Anybody remember what happens to the statue? There's a rock cut out without hands. And what does it do to the statue? We don't focus on this part, but what does it do to the statue? It breaks it in part. And then it grows into a mighty mountain. Well, what's the mighty mountain? What kingdom is that? It's us. We're that mighty mountain. But in order for that mighty mountain to happen, what has to happen first? What does the rock have to do? Destroy all four of those kingdoms. When Jesus was resurrected, what was the one thing that hadn't happened of that vision yet? All four of those kingdoms hadn't been destroyed. Only three of them had. Think of the timeline. Babylon was destroyed in 539 BC. Medo-Persia took over and then was destroyed in 330 BC. Greece took over, and then they were destroyed in 168 BC. Rome then took over in 2 BC. And then Jesus comes onto the earth in 33 AD. When Jesus died on the cross, who was in power? Rome. The statue still is right there, right? Then Jesus ascends up into heaven. Who's in charge? Rome is still in charge. That's the last piece of the puzzle to fulfill. We haven't completed that story yet of Daniel 2, which is what's so exciting to me about Revelation, is you think it is a completion of this vision that we've read about and we know about, but and we kind of skip over that last part, but really there's a piece there that we've not completed. That is, Jesus' kingdom cannot be exalted into the mountain that will last forever and ever until the entire statue is obliterated. We haven't seen that yet. In Micah 4, Micah says the same thing. He says, in the latter days it shall come to pass that the mountain of Jehovah's house shall be established on the top of the mountains, and it shall be exalted above the hills, and the people shall flow unto it. It was always told in the Old Testament that when Christ's kingdom came, it would be a mountain. That same kind of language that Daniel uses in the vision. It would be this great and powerful mountain. And that a mountain is a good visual for them, but maybe less of a visual for us, because we don't build like they did. If you were going to build a city, what did you build on? Build on a mountain, which we would call a hill. But it always built on a mountain. And every great city, every great capital was built on a mountain. Rome was built on seven mountains. The seven hills of Rome. That was just how you built. So if you're going to talk about having a great kingdom, well, the greatest kingdom sits on the highest mountain, right? That's kind of the visual aid that they had there. And so Micah said it, Isaiah said it, Daniel said it. The kingdom will be great and it will be exalted above all other kingdoms. But when Jesus came and he died on the cross and he bought the church with his blood, and then he ascended up into heaven, and then 50 days after his resurrection, the church begins. If you were to look at those 3,000 people on the day of Pentecost, would you be able to logically say that they were a greater mountain than Rome? I don't think you can. I don't think you can make that argument. Now, they were growing, and what does it say that the rock would do? It would grow into a mountain. But they had not obliterated Rome yet. If you ask anybody, what's the greatest kingdom out there? What's the great? It would be Rome. But today, what is it? Who's outlasted who? Who's greater? Who's spread to farther corners of the earth? See, this is the message of Revelation. It's the finishing of those apocalyptic books, which is really a beautiful, you know, tapestry that's woven through the Old Testament to the New. It's the completion of the story. It's the finishing of Daniel's vision. It's the destroying of the dreadful beast that was so terrifyingly dreadful that everybody feared it and should have in every way destroyed God's people. But the only reason God's people won was because God was with them.
It's kind of cool to just to picture this from Daniel's perspective, because he was in exile, and all he would have to build on is all the even older scriptures to talk about, but I will bring you back together and make it great.
You mean Daniel or John?
Daniel.
Oh, Daniel. So Daniel in Babylonian exile.
And
yeah.
All he could look back is like in Deuteronomy, mm-hmm. He says, but after you turn away from me, I will bring you back together. It's just cool to think that he could have sat there hoping in those scriptures.
Right.
And then it just all being fulfilled.
Yeah, absolutely. And so one of the internal evidences I use is that you look at the other apocalyptic books, and the other apocalyptic books tell a story that never got finished. And then you tie those in to Revelation, and there's a flow to it. There's a natural continuity there to the language, the apocalyptic language of the Old Testament is continued in Revelation, so you kind of continue the narrative that way. And then the subject matter is the same. We're going to deal with that last beast that we haven't killed yet. Everybody saw Babylon killed. Everybody saw Medo-Persia killed. Everybody saw Greece killed. But what about Rome? It's dreadfully terrifying. It's stronger than all the others. It's the great iron teeth beast. How can the church, which is such a small body of people, how can it ever defeat that? This is how. And really, Revelation paints that picture, that you will win in the end. And really, what's exciting about that is, it's this grand conflict between good and evil, resulting in the victory of the righteous and the defeat for the wicked. The conflict is spiritual, not physical or military. The message of the book is assurance of victory and triumph. It is a message to Christians who can't take up arms. I mean, what have Christians been told to do with the governing authorities? Submit to them. So you're here, your job as a Christian in the first and second and third century is to submit to Rome. What happens when Rome turns on you? You can't take up arms. You're not allowed. You're not allowed to militarize. That's not the nature of Christianity. It's not, you know, he who lives by the sword will die by the sword. This is not who we are meant to be. And yet we're told Rome, with all of its armies and all its military, all its strength, is going to lose against a bunch of people who won't even fight. Think of the craziness of that, right? That's crazier than David and Goliath. That's crazier than Gideon and his 300 men against the mighty army. It's no army. It's Gideon without even Gideon. It's David not even picking up one stone. It's completely crazy. In Acts chapter 5, Gamaliel was a teacher of law who, by the way, was the guy that trained Paul in Judaism. Paul say his feet. It says, at one time when they were trying to figure out what to do with Christianity, he made the statement, he says, men of Israel, take care of what you're about to do with these men. For before these days, Theudas rose up, claiming to be somebody, and a number of men, about 400, joined him. He was killed, and all who followed him were dispersed and came to nothing. After him, Judas the Galilean rose up in the days of the census and drew away some of the people after him. He too perished, and all who followed him were scattered. So in the present case, I tell you, keep away from these men and let them alone. For if this plan or this undertaking is of man, it will fail. But if it is of God, you will not be able to overthrow them. That is one of the truest statements made by an unbeliever ever. If God is with us, who can stand against us? And Revelation is the playing out of that truth. That it did not matter how many Christians Rome killed, it didn't matter how much they threw them to the lions, it didn't matter how terrifying they were, how much they tried to oppress them, Christianity lived. And what is Rome now? It's a country that is a tourist attraction. It's nothing. And that is the story of Revelation. Never in the history of the world had the church been more widely and systematically persecuted than it was under Roman rule. If the church can survive that persecution, it must be from God. And this gets back to that point of, it had to be useful for them, but what's the message for us? If the church could survive that, forget about it. Whatever can be thrown at us. You know, we worry as Christians. We look at the world around us. We look at the politics. We look at what's happening to America, and that gives us angst. I get it. I get it too. It's not. It's not wrong for us to be concerned about that. We know how nations go, and we know what happens if the nation becomes immoral. What happens to God's people? It does not get easy. But if under Rome, where they were in charge of the entire known world, they could attempt to destroy Christianity and lose against people who did nothing but just say, we trust God, what's the U.S. going to do? I mean, it really is. That's where the blessing is for you and I, is to see what they went through and to see how God protected them and how God talked to them. And God spoke and said, you just wait and I will take care of you, and how he did. You and I are on the other side, and we get the whole story. And it's just a beautiful thing. You know, God's kingdom cannot be overthrown, no matter how bleak it might seem, and no matter how it looks, Christ's church will be victorious. That's your message of the book of Revelation. What areas does the church seem victorious in? The education system, for us or against us? Scientific community, for us or against us? Entertainment industry, for us or against us? The culture, the political realm, for us or against us? Show me a single realm in American culture where you feel like you are the winner. It doesn't matter. I mean, this is why I get excited about Revelation. It doesn't matter. Because if that is true for us, how much more so was it for them under Roman rule? They had it so much worse. Nobody's throwing us to the Colosseum, right? There's reality TV, but you're not in it. You know what I mean? You're not center stage for that stuff. We've not resisted to the point of blood. They did, and it didn't matter. And the other piece of that puzzle is not only did God make them victorious through it, what we find is that historically Christians were made of such sterner stuff than they thought they were. I mean, that's the other piece of that puzzle, is that you are stronger than you think you are. And that God's people, they got to a point where Christians, they expected to be put to death. There's a book called Fox's Book of Martyrs, and it's a historical account of all people who were martyred. And some of the early ones talk about people being martyred under Roman rule. And it was grisly. Rome would take you to the Colosseum, they'd throw you lines, you remember that part. But what they don't tell you is the other ones were like, they would stake them out in the hot sun, they would fillet you open, fill you with pig feet, and then let the hogs come and eat you. That sort of stuff happened all the time. That was a weekday in the Colosseum. And they had Colosseums all over the country, too. We think of the Colosseum, there were Colosseums everywhere for the entertainment of people. Rome had a philosophy of bread and circuses. If you give the people bread and you give them entertainment, you'll keep them happy. We were the entertainment. And Christians got to the point where not only did they stand firm, but there were times where Christians didn't. You know, they'd give their pinch of incense in a moment of weakness, and they'd feel so bad, they'd go back the next day and they'd pound on the doors of these Colosseums and say, let me in, I should be in. It was just a different quality of people. And persecution didn't crush them, it made them. And that's also in the book of Revelation. So it's not just what happens externally doesn't matter, it's what happens internally is all that matters. You know, it's the outward man perishing and the inner man being renewed day by day. So it's just a really powerful book with that context in mind. So with that, we're kind of at time for tonight. Does anybody have any questions? Yeah.
Because without this being Rome and the later date or whatever, there's no, I guess, like, send-off for Christianity as it will stand after the Bible has been written. You
right.
know, like, you see Jesus in Matthew 24, and he's giving the disciples, like, when you see the 70 AD stuff, like, don't be afraid, you'll conquer it, right? But we would also need something for the even greater than that.
Right.
And it's just interesting to think about that way. The question is, what argument does anybody have against the consistency of the beast in Revelation and the beast in Daniel being so similar?
Okay, so the early date view does say that beast is
Rome.
But then they wrap it back to Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And so it's not, Rome is this, it's a side note. And to be fair, I was actually even reading that today to, like, try and have a better understanding of that that viewpoint, the Ogden early day viewpoint. That's one of the disconnects for me, is it's like you talk about this, but then you go back to the Paula Drewson, and I don't see the continuity of it. They admit that that has to be, but then I don't see how then that pertains. And that's one thing I've never felt like I've gotten a good answer on, and I've not been able to wrap my mind around. So I'm not sure I can give a really great answer to
so
that.
So I guess like the premillennial view would then be like, yeah, too similar.
So the premillennial view would say there's going to arise another nation just like Rome.
Okay.
That would be how they would go about it. Yeah. Any else? Okay, so we'll shut down there, and we'll move in next week to looking at some of that, more of that imagery, and getting squared away with the imagery and symbolism.